Okay, I think we have everyone with us at this point. My name is Donna McCandlish, and first of all, good afternoon. Welcome to what is our second session in the 2020 Embracing Aging series. Our session today is entitled Aging in Place, Growing Older, Staying at Home. In January, our guests from Comfort Life and Redcoats provided insights on things to consider and how to prepare for transitioning to a retirement community. Our guest today, Margot McWhirter, will discuss ideas for creating spaces that help older adults to stay safe and independent in their own homes or condos, free of barriers and adaptable to their changing needs. I'm going to tell you more about Margot in just a minute, but before then I just want to mention a few things. If you attended our last session and didn't manage to take away the retirement residence checklist we were handing out, of course we ran out of them. I do have some copies, so if you are still looking for one, you can see me after this session and I'd be happy to give you one. Another, if you wish to receive bulletins and other information about upcoming sessions and have not already done so, please sign the leave your email address on the list that we will be circulating. For the most part, members of ESG are already on our list. Are there people who are coming from outside ESG? Maybe just a quick show of hands. Okay, so we do have a couple of you in the room. Finally, one of our sponsors for this, Del Manor Inspired Retirement Living, is with us today. Christy Chapin, Community Relations Manager for Del Manor, is here, and she will be around after the session as well if you want to gather any information from her around what they have to offer. So with that, let me now turn to talking about Margot. Margot is a seasoned occupational therapist. Through her company, Inclusive Aging, she brings a unique perspective to her work with individuals, caregivers, groups and businesses, including occupational therapy, gerontology, universal design, adult learning, and system navigation. With a master's degree in gerontology and over 25 years of experience in both the public and private healthcare sectors, she is passionate about promoting social inclusion to, in her words, help people achieve success in whatever roles and environments are most meaningful to them. Margot is a true multi-specialist. Having worked as a clinical occupational therapist working to restore the functional abilities of her clients within the community and rehabilitation and acute care hospitals, having undertaken research projects in the community and in long-term care homes, having applied her knowledge and skills to work with the home health division of a major national pharmacy chain, educating consumers and healthcare providers on a range of assistive devices, empowering them to make informed decisions about issues affecting their daily lives. Having worked as an educator, a clinical consultant, and a public speaker. Having published or been involved with the publication of relevant content and contributed as an active member to the Canadian Standards Association on the Technical Committee on Accessible Design for the Built Environment, and having conducted many accessibility audits of private homes and public spaces, resulting in recommendations that reduce barriers faced by people with physical and or cognitive limitations. Margot, the list of your accomplishments and contributions is very, very impressive. Thank you for joining us today. Please welcome Margot.
Thank you very much, Donna, and thank you. I'd forgotten that I'd given you such a lengthy introduction. It's my absolute pleasure to be here today, and especially on this snowy day, I'm particularly grateful and appreciative that you've either come to church and stayed, or that you've come after the church service to hear the presentation today. Thank you again to Donna and to the organizing committee for inviting me and doing such a fantastic job of collating and coordinating such an impressive group of speakers. And again, I'm really pleased to be here today. I have this Madonna mic. I'm told that it's not named after the Holy Spirit, the Holy Madonna, but by the actress. I'm not sure in heels that I'll attempt to do what that Madonna can do in terms of singing and dancing. But is everybody able to hear me okay? Okay, I understand there were some challenges last time, and if there are any issues, particularly if I start to speed up when I get excited about things, I start to talk quickly, just wave your hand at me and I'll try to remember to slow down. So Donna has kindly told you quite a bit about me, and I'm going to share a little bit more about my experience, but particularly as a public educator and speaker, I'm always interested to know a little bit more about the people that I'm speaking with and speaking to. Some of you I have known for a very long time, and some of you are new in terms of faces and your experiences. But I am going to ask 5 questions and just get you to respond as a group through a show of hands. So the first question that I am wondering is, who here lives in a house or a townhouse, someplace with stairs and probably a yard? Okay, great. And hands down. Thank you. Who lives in a condominium or an apartment building? All right, slightly smaller group, but still significant. And does anybody here live in either a retirement community or a senior's residence where you may be getting some assistance with housekeeping and maybe meals and personal care? A few of you. Wonderful. Last 2 questions. How many of you live alone? Okay, so that's a fairly substantial piece. And if you follow the media at all, I'm sure you know a lot about the statistics of living alone and the crisis that's happening internationally in terms of loneliness. And then the very last question that I have is, who here identifies as a caregiver, either for family member, friends, or neighbor of any age? Okay, terrific. Thank you so much. So just to give you a bit of a sense of how, as a group, as well as individuals, you fit into some of the Canadian statistics, and I should point out the handout package that you received has most of my slides, but some of them that I wasn't sure was going to translate very well into a smaller image. You don't have copies of those. But what we know from Statistics Canada is that at the age of 65, so there's about 6 million Canadians over the age of 65, fully 90% of individuals at that age are still living or continue to live in their own home, condo, or an apartment. And that number stays very strong. The vast majority of people, even at the age of 85, are living in that situation. It's only once you meet the, you know, century milestone, so certainly probably closer to age 95 and 100, where we see the proportion of older adults at that age still living in their own apartment, condo, or home. So that might go against some of the grain or the media messages that we get about where older adults live as they age. In terms of the statistics around living alone, about a quarter of older Canadians, 65 years and older, live alone. So again, the vast majority of older adults actually do have somebody else that they're living with. At age 85, these numbers change slightly. So about 37% of women live alone versus almost 22% of men. And that's partly explained by the difference in life expectancy. In terms of caregiving, the statistics from Stats Canada tell us that Canadians 15 years of age and older, because there's a whole cohort that's getting a lot more attention by researchers as well as by government, is younger caregivers. But for all Canadians over the age of 15, about one quarter identifies being a caregiver for somebody with a physical or a cognitive impairment or a developmental disability, as well as somebody who's experiencing the effects of aging. And in fact, when census data and surveys are being collected, aging is the number one reason that caregivers are identifying why they need to provide care to somebody with a long-term impairment. So really, what these statistics show, and thank you for your audience participation, what we see, again, is that the norm is for older Canadians to remain living in their home well into their 80s, often with another individual or with caregiving assistance from somebody their own age or even younger. And something to bear in mind is that's the statistics, that's the reality that bears out in the group today. But another thing that doesn't get talked about as much is that the majority of older adults are actually living in outdated housing stock that was never designed for an aging population. And as an occupational therapist, one of the things that I know and other OTs know as well is the importance of the designed environment on our day-to-day function. We don't really think about it because we just sort of make do. Are there any left-handed people in the audience? Okay, a few. You probably get by in a right-handed world and sometimes suffer and sometimes you triumph because you've figured out ways around things. But that sort of accommodation or adjustment or just putting up with things is sort of the norm. And it's only once we stop to think about how the world around us is designed to either help or potentially hinder us that we maybe start to say, is this something that I can do something about? And I would challenge or, you know, strongly suggest that the answer is yes. But we do have to sort of call it into awareness and then make those adjustments. So Donna already read out my biography, so you're going to know a lot of this already, but I am a registered occupational therapist, often referred to as OT, and no, we're not just physios with a different title. I have a master's degree in gerontology, which is the study of aging, and then I also hold certificates in universal design and patient navigation. So universal design, for those of you who don't aren't familiar with that term, it's a design of buildings and spaces as well as products that are intended and intentionally designed to be usable by people of all ages and abilities as well as body type and size without the need for special accommodation. So years ago, we talked a lot about barrier-free design, which is absolutely critically important. However, if we're only focusing on people's mobility, then we are potentially excluding people with other abilities and ranges of abilities, or we might be segregating and needing to provide special accommodation. So a couple of fairly standard examples of universally designed features out in the everyday world that you might encounter are things like curb cuts on the sidewalk, as well as the sliding doors when you're entering and leaving grocery stores, large grocery stores. Those are things that benefit everybody, and whether you're, a mom with a stroller, whether you're somebody using a mobility device, or you just have difficulty because of arthritis in your hands or limited arm strength of opening and closing doors, you can access that space, and certainly it's much safer when you're stepping on and off a curb if you're not having to step up and down off of a non-curb cut design. In terms of the patient navigation certificate that I hold, I got that at York University last year, and that's a newer role within the healthcare spectrum. It started in the U.S. in the cancer care realm, and really the idea of patient navigation, and it's spread beyond cancer care most certainly and into Canada now as well, is the idea that the healthcare system is a complex entity. And even as somebody who has worked in healthcare for 25 years, I don't know everything, and things are often changing. So it can be particularly overwhelming for people who are less familiar with the healthcare system, who may be trying to make decisions and source out information in the midst of a crisis, to figure their way through the system. So a patient navigation role is really one that is a process by which somebody is assisted to overcome barriers within the healthcare system and to access necessary services that they might require. So a patient navigator functions both as an information resource, oftentimes as an advocate with or on behalf of an individual, whether that's in the community or if they're in hospital, as well as in some cases doing some of the practical coordination of day-to-day care and services that an individual or a household might require. My 25 years experience has primarily been working with older adults. It's always been a long-time passion of mine, and I have worked throughout the healthcare system, primarily in home care, but also in an acute care and an inpatient rehab setting, as well as through convalescent care, retirement, and long-term care. And my training and education role was primarily providing information and education with other healthcare professionals, but also with clients and family caregivers, and then with students who were learning either to become personal support workers or rehab professionals. And then my most recent accomplishment is to start my own private practice, Inclusive Aging, which in which I specialize in aging in place. That includes that patient navigation role and then home modifications, which is going to be the bulk of the presentation today. So just to go through in a little bit more information in terms of what occupational therapy is for people who don't know. We are university-trained, regulated healthcare professionals, so the same as a doctor, a pharmacist, a nurse, a physiotherapist, and others. Occupational therapists in particular are experts in health and disability issues across the lifespan. So I focus on geriatrics. Other OTs will focus on perhaps adolescent mental health or pediatrics. But the thing is, because we're experts in health and disability issues, we're really well positioned in an aging population where so many people are experiencing the effects of chronic diseases and disabilities as opposed to acute ones that might require medical attention. We work very closely with a medical model and with medical healthcare practitioners, but we really take a more social approach to healthcare. And the thing that distinguishes occupational therapy from any other healthcare profession is our focus on function. The history of OT, and this will just be a very quick lesson for you, it actually started in World War I. With the recognition here, partly in England, but partly in Toronto over at Lyndhurst Hospital at that time, where occupational therapists and medical doctors realized that veterans who had activities and tasks to occupy their time recovered faster because they weren't focused on their injury, on their disability, and they were basically motivated and able to recover more quickly. So this idea of assessing and treating meaningful occupations by assessing what a person's daily routines and activities are is at the core of occupational therapy. And we look at the building blocks of the individual. So what do you need to be able to do a basic task such as getting in and out of bed, moving around your house, and managing your personal care? And then both physically and cognitively, what are the skills that you need to do for what we call instrumental activities of daily living? Things like meal preparation, managing your finances, transportation, grocery shopping, organizing appointments. Those are things that, you know, all of those things require that certain building block, and our ability to evaluate an individual's ability to do those things and then make recommendations based on our assessment and what the goals of the individual are. We're also specialists, as I've mentioned before, in understanding how a person's environment, in this case the home environment, can either support or hinder the things that you want or need to do. And then we're really good at knowing how to match the solutions to your abilities and limitations using that client-centered approach. So, final couple of slides before we move some more into the content specifically around aging in place is, so if an occupational therapist, if you're working with an OT, what can you expect them to do? Well, they are going to, we do assess your individual abilities, challenges, and needs. And that can be starting with an interview, questions such as, do you have any pain or difficulty, does pain limit you to do daily activities? Or is there some other medical condition that you have that impacts your ability to do the things that you want and need to do? In other cases, especially where somebody might have a cognitive impairment and may not be able to sort of tell us directly, then what we would do is actually watch an individual perform that variety of tasks we talked about in the previous slide in order to make recommendations. We also conduct home assessments and recommend changes so that the things that you want and need to do are easier and safer for you. And also, if you need a caregiver, because we have to ensure that we're considering all people within that activity and within the household. And that recommendation can include things like furnishings as well as equipment, products and services that would make it easier and safer for you to do those things. And in some cases, we're either going to suggest or actually demonstrate and possibly do some training around techniques that make essential activities easier to do. And certainly as a newer OT grad, when I was working at an inpatient hospital, really struck me that I was at that point quite a bit younger than a lot of the patients I was treating, and I was explaining to somebody who'd had a stroke, maybe somebody who had an amputation or was living with post-polio syndrome and then had other comorbid health problems come along, how to do things that we all take for granted. But that recognition that the way we've always done things should be the way we always continue to do things is part of the idea of successfully aging in place, recognizing what is important to us to be able to continue to do, and do I need to maybe adapt or change how I'm doing that in order to make it possible and still safe for me to do so. And then for occupational therapists such as myself who specialize in aging in place, I collaborate with designers, architects, and contractors to develop a home modification plan that meets your specific needs, and then work with you after the modifications or the equipment or the services have been installed in order to ensure that you're using them safely and correctly. So now we're going to move into what is aging in place and talk a lot more about the things that you can do to make it possible for you to remain in the home of your choice for as long as you are able, while also getting the assistance that you require to meet your needs. The thing to recognize about aging in place is it's not a passive thing. It's not just the passage of time that means that you stay in the home that you've always lived in and you're growing older. It's much more proactive, recognizing how your needs are changing over time, and our needs personally fluctuate quite often, right? If you're a morning person, you may not have the same energy or the abilities later on in the day. If you have a touch of the flu, your balance or your thinking may not be as clear. And then certainly as we age, there's a number of changes that are happening within us naturally. And we can take some steps in terms of our diet and our exercise and our lifestyle to try to limit some of the negative consequences of that. But there are other changes we're not going to be able to halt or stop. And so we need to recognize those and then take steps to think ahead and to plan how we're going to adjust our lifestyle and our living arrangements to accommodate for those changes. The other thing to recognize is that when you are making those changes and you're planning ahead, one of the things that you're actually doing is planning to maintain control over what's happening to you and around you. And that sense of control is really, really critical to life satisfaction. So again, that idea that aging in place is not a passive activity, but one where you're actively involved in the process, you're preserving your dignity and you're maintaining your quality of life, or at least taking steps to make that more positive, is a important thing to recognize in this. So in terms of preparing to age in place, it really means quite systematically thinking about a whole range of areas of your life where you can control and give some consideration to the things that you want to take action on now versus later. And apologize for some of the clarity of this slide. So in the center is health, because health is really huge. If we don't have our health, then a lot of other things suffer. So for sure you want to make sure that you are working with your doctor and other healthcare professionals to do everything that you can to maintain a healthy lifestyle and to limit some of the negative consequences that can happen as a result of aging. But you also want to think about what happens if you're no longer able to maintain certain lifestyle habits, or you're incapable of making decisions on your own. So thinking about what your wishes might be if you became incapacitated, and then making sure that you're telling people. Tied to that as well is thinking about that living situation. Where do you live now? Is that something that you, someplace you want to continue living? And what do you need to do to think about modifying that space to make it safe and practical for you to continue to do so? We're obviously going to get a lot more into that. But in addition, you also want to think about and plan ahead around transportation. Are you going to continue driving? What happens if you lose your license for whatever reason? You may give it up voluntarily, which is the preferable thing to do in terms of your sense of control, but you might lose it as a result of a catastrophic situation, and so then you don't want to become isolated in your home. You want to take steps to plan ahead of a crisis so you're not making hasty decisions. Thinking about things like your finances as well as your social connections, having that social connectivity to friends and family, exploring alternate means of keeping connected to your community and to family far and close is important. And then recognizing there's a whole host of supports and services that are available in your community, whether it's paid help or whether it's informal help, that can allow you to continue to do those activities that you need and want to do for your health and your sense of self, with some assistance. This slide talks about the stages of aging in place. And it's not a linear process. So the top box talks about no immediate needs. So this would be a phase that where you're really not experiencing any significant changes in your health, and certainly probably little or no changes to your mobility. There's no age or decade that's tied with this, and it's not a linear process. You may start in one place, jump to the next, and then fall back. The middle box is for individuals with chronic or progressive condition-based needs. So this could be if you're living with chronic back pain, if you have difficulty breathing, either because of heart or lung challenges, if you have arthritis that affects your ability to have good hand function and dexterity and strength. You may have mobility changes which limit your ability to manage stairs. Or you might have a chronic disease such as Parkinson's disease or diabetes. And then the last box there is the urgent needs due to sudden or traumatic changes. And I will say, after 25 years of working in the healthcare sphere, majority of people don't think about starting to make changes until that urgent need. Because they're, you know, I'm fine, I'll manage, I'll deal with it when it comes up, or that's not going to happen to me. And that's human nature, right? It's human nature to either hope your way out of a situation, which you really means you're going to hope your way into a less ideal situation, or to say, oh no, I have a plan, but I'm not ready to implement that plan yet. And the reality is that most aging in place plans that people do start to think about and say, yes, I will do that, you need to start implementing that plan before you actually feel ready, so you don't set yourself up for failure. So now we're going to move on to talking about features of a forever home. And this, what I'm going to present now is really a partial list. You know, there's really thick textbooks and research that's been written about all of the things that you can and hopefully will do or should be doing to try and ensure that the home that you're living in is a forever home. Now, some individuals don't want that. They do have plans to either downsize or they anticipate because of a health history that they will need to move into more supportive housing sooner rather than later. But the thing to remember is the information I'm about to present is based on universal design features, which means that these are features that should be in all of our homes because they are useful and beneficial to people of all ages and abilities. So very often, the same features that can be useful for somebody with maybe limited mobility, whether or not you use a cane or a walker or a wheelchair, can also be helpful if you're bringing groceries in from the car or if you're bringing golf clubs in after a game. So that's an example of how features that can be beneficial for some are really beneficial for all. And as much as it's absolutely acceptable and appropriate, some people choose to move into a retirement home or a senior center, and some people have to move into long-term care homes, I will say from a functional standpoint, those settings are not designed with an aging population in mind from a functional standpoint. They're designed for amenities. They're designed to provide you with the care and support that you might need. And some of it's changing, but a lot of it is really overlooked in terms of what would be beneficial to older adults who are experiencing a change in vision and hearing, a change in mobility, a change in flexibility and strength and endurance. So this first list are basically features that would be useful throughout your home. So it would apply to many different rooms. And I've broken it down into three different categories just so that it's not this long list. And I will say that if these next few slides have more pictures, but I wanted to make sure that I got some of these things in place. So in terms of comfort and ease of use, and these are applicable both to condos as well as to homes, and you may already have some of these features in your home, which is a great way to go. So lever door handles and faucets, way easier to manipulate than the old turnstile faucets and door handles. Similarly with rocker-style light switches and programmable thermostats, which means you don't have to be adjusting and particularly using fine motor control and good vision to see what that thermostat is. D-shaped handles, and basically that just means like if you think of a U or a D shape that you can put your fingers into and with very little effort open and close. The one of the tests for a universal design on controls is if you can control or move that control, that dial, that touchpad or whatever with a closed fist, then that's a good test of whether or not that product's universally designed. Because for whatever reason, people lose the ability to either grip or manipulate their fine fingers to a varying degree. I'm not suggesting that, you know, we all get to an age and stage where we can't do these things, but invariably, if you make your home a haven from some of the challenges that's happening in the outside world as well as within you, you're not going to be as exhausted. In terms of storage, focus on shallow shelves and drawers so that you're not having to climb either down or up onto ladders and fish into the backs of drawers and cupboards. And then lowered light switches and raised outlets. Those are all things that just make it easier for you to use features within your home. In terms of safety, and home safety assessments are a huge part of what occupational therapists do as well, I put lighting up there as the top one because that's really, really important for your safety. Our eyes change not only in terms of visual acuity, but in terms of our ability to adapt to particularly low lighting levels, and we need more light the older we get. So really in multiple areas throughout your home, especially around stairs, it's really, really important to have more light rather than less. The use of color contrast can also be good if you have difficulty with your vision and distinguishing things like the edge of a stair or even the edge of a counter or where an outlet is on a wall. Removing tripping hazards. Again, after 25 years of being an OT, I feel like I've said, you know, remove those scatter rugs, no trailing cords and wires. You know, that's a basic and a given. The idea of having handrails on both sides of the stairs is important. It's not necessarily that you're walking up or down, gripping both sides, but we have a dominant side, and we generally hold on to the railing when it's there on our dominant side, and if it's not there, going the other direction, we're going to miss that. Grab bars in the bathroom. We'll talk a bit more about bathrooms in a few moments. And then smoke and carbon monoxide detectors located throughout the home. If you have reduced hearing and the carbon monoxide detector or smoke detector is well away from where you can hear it in your bedroom or your den or wherever you might happen to drift off, then that's not doing you a lot of good. In terms of mobility, and these are things that are going to start to push the envelope a little bit and say, well, I'm not going to do all of this, change to my house, I'll move before I do this. That's fine. But again, recognize that if you are doing a home renovation project, and some of you, either yourselves or family members, may be looking to do additions or new builds, these are things that can be absolutely aesthetically beautiful, but will also be functional at any age. So the idea of having zero-step thresholds, it's amazing how we either, because of inattention, or we may not be able to lift our feet as well, we can catch our foot just on the smallest of a lip at the doorway, either coming in or out of a home or between rooms, and we can end up tripping and falling. Slip-resistant flooring. So generally speaking, wooden flooring is good, or cork flooring that has a little bit of cushioning. It's going to be far more effective and useful as well if you end up using a mobility device, whether it's a walker or a wheelchair, than, say, a thick plush carpet. Doorways, ideally minimum of 32 to 36 inch wide in order to allow for easy passage. And then hallways, especially if you have 90-degree turns off of the hallway, 36 to 42 inches wide, again, for lots of maneuverability, and so you're less likely to bump into doorways and down the hallway as you're moving along. It's not a common feature in Canada, but certainly in the U.S., the idea of having a master bedroom and a bathroom on the main floor is a plus. And more people are starting to at least create that possibility by either roughing in or planning ahead if they're no longer able to manage the stairs in their home. And obviously there are devices, and we're going to talk a bit more about that in a little bit as well. If your master bedroom and bathroom are up on a second level and there's no space for you to relocate that to the main floor, then looking at things like stair lifts. In terms of entrances and exits, high visibility house numbers, really important, and I do apologize, some of these slides aren't going to be as visually descriptive, but the idea of having high visibility house numbers, you know where you live, but a visitor may not, and certainly if EMS, if emergency medical services, if you needed to have somebody come and assist you, you want them to be able to find your house quickly. The other thing is you might consider a distinct color on your front door or your garage door. Whether that's for you or whether that's for somebody in your community who uses that as an orientation and wayfinding method. So there's an interesting study done by urban planners in University of Waterloo who tracked people with cognitive impairment moving around their community, and found that those individuals couldn't, you know, necessarily list their home address or even say where they were, but they knew when they got to the house with the yellow mailbox that they turned left. So that kind of idea is interesting. The idea of that gentle sloped ramp and use of landscaping, or if you need to have a porch lift so that if you have difficulty getting in and out of your home and are needing to use a mobility device, that's a way to continue living in that space and able to access. A covered porch, just so that while you are opening and closing your door, you're protected from the elements. And then a side light window or a peephole or a visual doorbell alarm, basically some way for security that you can see who's there at the door without opening the door first. In addition, the idea of having a bench, particularly inside the door that you usually use to enter and exit your home, so that you have some place to sit and take your shoes on and off. again, the idea can be like, well, I always stand or I lean against the wall. But as you age, your ability to do that safely can change. So having a bench or a chair there is beneficial. And the idea behind having a shelf on the outside is so that you have some place to put your bags, your briefcase, or your purse while you're fishing out your keys. So we're going to get into some more specifics that would be universal for anybody, because obviously not everybody's going to live in a house still with an exit and entrance that they have any control over. But bathrooms are one of the riskiest rooms in the house, especially when it comes to falls, and that's because of the water factor, right? So you want to really ensure that the features here are ones that are going to keep you safe but also independent. So the idea of a comfort height toilet, so those are toilets that are sort of 2 inches or 3 inches taller than the standard toilet, and they're becoming more commonplace, are excellent aging-in-place devices or fixtures for you to consider. You can get a over-toilet commode, or you can get a raised toilet seat as well if you're only going to need that adjustment on a temporary basis. But for most people, they do find now where they are used to using a comfort height toilet, when they go to sit on a lower toilet, it's a long way down. And what's hard to get down is equally or more so hard to get up against gravity. If you've got a bad back, if you've got, sore knees or hips or weaker leg muscles. Having grab bars beside the toilet, whether it's wall-mounted, whether it's a flip-down grab bar or even a floor-to-ceiling pole, depending on how much space you've got around your toilet. And I have put in there no angled grab bars, please. That's not just a personal or a professional opinion. There's actually a study that's been done by the Canadian Mortgage and Housing, and it's based on human physiology, and it recognizes that we have way more power if we're either pulling ourselves up to stand or especially if we're pushing. And that bar that's at 45 degrees or 40 degrees is, I say, it's at a perfect angle to be useful to nobody. Other than if some people kind of lean this way, and if you're off balance and you're leaning, you're not actually using your leg muscles, which is what you're supposed to be using to stand up. Say again? So, in the picture, I will say, I couldn't get pictures that adequately demonstrate everything, but yes, that's why I also put in the brackets there no angled bars, like is shown in the picture. If it's an option, and this would require a bit more renovation than you may be planning, but thinking about a sink with knee space underneath, so that if you did need to or choose to perform activities at the sink and sitting, that you've got the ability to really get up under there, so you're not having to approach it sideways on, spitting in and then having to wash around the sink or not, depending on who you live with. Being able to get up under the sink, and that means no pedestal, right? It's actually either a wall-hung sink or one that's mounted directly into the vanity. The idea behind having smaller floor tiles, and especially ones with grout, I'm not saying they have to be penny tiles, but this idea of going with huge 12 or 24-inch marble tiles with no grout lines because it's aesthetically pleasing, basically, going back to, I'm not going to remember the movie, but that idea of skating across the floor and wiping out. If you have smaller tiles, 4, 6, 8 inches with some grout lines, that's going to act as a buffer, a stop. So that's better for you than the large tiles. Maximizing easy access storage, whether it's cupboards or open shelves, and on the countertop as well. Generally speaking, whether it's in the bathroom or the kitchen, I say if you can maximize your storage between shoulder height and knee height, that's going to serve you well because you're not going to have to bend or reach into low or high cupboards. And then does anybody know why a swing out or a pocket door is a good idea? Or a barn door? Say again? Proper access? Yep. Yeah. So because of the danger and the risk of falling in the bathroom, if you're inside the bathroom by yourself, and you fall inside, especially if it's a small space, or you fall against the door, if the door opens in, people can't get in to help you. So having a door that swings out, or one of, the pocket doors or a barn door, is a better option. It's a safer option. In terms of, and this really doesn't show on the image, so I apologize for that, but grab bars, again, not only by the toilet, but in the shower, and also looking at having a curbless shower rather than one either with a small lip or a shower in a tub. So it's a bit of preference and a bit of you take what you can get. A curbless shower is the best because that means that you can walk in or roll in if you needed to use a device without any risk of tripping and the need to step up and over. And then the idea with the grab bar is you want a vertical grab bar on the transfer, close to the transfer side. You then want probably at least a horizontal grab bar inside as well as another vertical one. If you are trying to use the grab bar inside the shower or over the tub to step in, you're throwing yourself off balance to get in and out. And if you do have a bathtub, if that's the only option, I will say that your stability is far better if you actually think about standing sideways. So if the tub is this way, your stability is way better if you bring your heel to your butt and step this way rather than trying to step forward or back. You're much more likely to throw yourself off balance. The value of height-adjustable handheld showers, again, universally beneficial, whether you're... Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the question is, how is it possible to avoid getting water all over the floor with a curbless shower? And that's where, obviously, working with a qualified contractor is really important. In a home situation, you're often able to accomplish that with a long drain. So that's going, and a slightly sloped floor. So the drainage is really what's the critical piece. In a condo where it may be harder to drill down and actually get more of that, not sunken, but level, then it may be a matter of again, looking at adequate drainage, but where there is just a slight lip and there may be limited ability to slope the floor, there are basically rubber dams that are can be installed on the side of a shower stall with adhesive that helps to contain the water. But it comes down to drainage. Shower stools or benches, those can either be built in, or there's certainly a range of medical suppliers where you can get those products, and they are available with or without a back support. You want to, if you have the ability to control the water temperature, and this can be useful for somebody with a neurological impairment of any kind, but set the water temperature at or below 120 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's so that you reduce your risk of scalding yourself. And heaven forbid, if you were home alone and you were in the bathtub or the shower and you fell against the faucet, you know, this is a problem that does happen, you're not going to have scalding water running on you. In terms of the kitchen, really, again, reinforcing the importance of all kinds of lighting, so both natural and task lighting. The appropriate use, the effective use, the aesthetic use of color contrasting so that you can see edges, but you can also distinguish where the counter ends and where the backsplash is, or upper or lower cabinetry. The idea of having shallower sinks, particularly if you're going to have open space underneath, if you're going to need to sit. And some people simply sit on a small or a tall stool because they've got back problems. In other cases, if you're standing at the sink but you're finding that you've got back pain, opening up the cupboards underneath, like just opening the doors and putting your foot on the lower edge of the shelf, that can be a way to ease some of the pain in your back. For people who want the option of being able to prepare food and prepare meals while seating, having varied height counters, and then to reduce the risk of injury, really damaging or hurting yourself, the idea of having rounded corners on countertops is also valuable. And then a side-by-side fridge freezer, it's not that you're not going to be using the full height of both of those, but it gives you that option and flexibility to maximize the storage height within an easy reach range rather than having potentially a low freezer that you're having to bend over and potentially losing balance or having issues that way. Some additional things that, again, may not be applicable in all situations, but where you can either raise or lower your appliance height so that it's at counter height or slightly below, that's going to be a lot easier for you to access in the event that you were needing to do things in a seated position. And then something that's possible in terms of retrofitting, if you're not redoing all of your kitchen, is the idea of replacing cupboards or installing a retrofit with pull-out drawers. It's also possible to have pull-down upper cabinets to make that space more accessible to you. And that can be done either manually or electronically, mechanically. And then the idea of thinking about if you are replacing appliances and just generally thinking about where you're going to put light switches and outlets and whatnot is move them to the front of the countertop or look at appliances that have controls at the front so that you're not reaching across a hot element or that you're not needing to reach across a deep countertop in order to access the outlets. And then taking advantage of things like counter space to slide heavier objects across rather than lifting and carrying and potentially dropping them and injuring yourself or creating a spill that could be a fall hazard. So some other considerations, and this is really going, Lazy Susans, yes, in the kitchen. Yeah, absolutely. A lazy Susan can be a great help. Sometimes what can happen is things drop off the back and then you're down on your hands and knees and trying to find those things. But absolutely, that's, and again, to go back to the idea of the universal design features, there are a lot of companies now, and IKEA is a good example, Lee Valley for those of us who like hardware stores and fancy hardware stores, who have developed products that are useful for a lot of people and they're aesthetically attractive. They don't have to be for people with special needs. And, aging is not a disease. I like to remind people of that. It's just something that happens to all of us. So you don't need special needs, but you are all special. So in terms of some other considerations, really just thinking about the height and depth of furniture and the placement of furniture within the room so you've got that maneuverability space and you're not creating tripping hazards. Generally speaking, whether it's a fixture like a toilet or a dining room chair or a living room chair or sofa, if you stand next to it and you see that the height of the furniture is at your knee level or slightly above, that's going to be a lot easier for you to get up and down from than if it's at knee level or below. And there are things like furniture risers. You can sometimes not necessarily double up on cushions, but create a little bit of a lift that way. And for some of us that are long in the body and short in the legs, we also need to have pillows behind us if we're ending up sitting on a sofa that's really deep, because it can be really, really hard to get up from a sofa that's way too deep. The idea of relocating washers and dryers from the basement, just so that you either aren't introducing that element of risk of carrying laundry up and down the stairs, or you're not needing to do something that could potentially be very fatiguing for you. And then for, as I'd mentioned previously, for individuals who want and need the assistance with navigating between levels in their home, there's now, not only are there stair lifts or chair lifts, there's what's called incline platform lifts that you can actually wheel onto with a mobility device like a walker or a wheelchair. And there's even residential elevators. So I don't know if you can see, but the first column of images is showing a residential elevator coming through the ceiling, then at one landing level, so one floor of the home, and then descending down into the next level down. And these are things that don't require as much infrastructure as a full-on elevator. Those are available too, and very, you know, nice designs, etc. But that would require more electronics and a elevator pit and whatnot. So just recognize, for whatever challenges you might be experiencing and identifying for yourself or with the help of an OT, that there is a solution, because you're not the only person who's experiencing that. And so it's a matter of being informed and educated in terms of what is available and then making the decision there. And then the last piece in terms of the other considerations is around technology and automation. So again, a lot of things that we didn't necessarily grow up with, but we now take for granted, whether it's a microwave oven or a TV clicker, or, you know, even remote control opening of blinds and drapes, those are all ways of introducing automation into the home that can make it easier and potentially safer for you to continue to live there. And then in terms of technology, I mean, that's just bursting at the seams in terms of what's available. The image that I have there is it's a product. It's a series of sensors that's been developed by a Canadian company out in Nova Scotia called Home Accept. And it's a non-intrusive sensor system. So there's no wearables, there's no cameras, there's no listening devices. But what it is ambient sensors that detects normal movement patterns in the individual household. So if there's one or more of you living in the home. And what it does is, through that artificial intelligence and that continual sensing, is it starts to detect the predictability in your movement patterns. And when there is an exception to that, it sends an alert to whomever you've identified as somebody who should call and check. So it can function as a fall detector, but because the ambient sensors also pick up changes in the environment, so if there's a significant change in noise level, so if things get very quiet, like help, help, or very, very quiet, sorry, very loud or very quiet, if there's a change in temperature, those sorts of things, this system will pick that up. It's only one example, but I like to highlight it because it is a Canadian example, and they've really dealt with, and they are dealing with, the privacy issue nicely. You're going to get a microphone. Yes. We're just going to turn that on.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Bathtubs.
Yes.
Have a very high step-in wall.
Mm-hmm.
Some are available that swing out like a door.
Yes.
Do you have experience with those?
In terms of the walk-in tubs?
Yes.
Yes. Yep, I certainly do. So that's another option, because there are some people who love a bathtub. And that's a great solution. You do want to pay attention to the drainage, because one of the potential downsides is that you can be sitting a long time in the tub waiting for it to fill up and waiting for it to drain because of the drainage issue. Generally speaking, I recommend, if you're going to put that in to your home, install a heat lamp as well, so that you aren't sitting there freezing as you're waiting for the tub to fill and empty. The other thing is, the actual door is not extremely wide. So if you've got some gifts on the side or behind, you want to make sure that you actually have the ability to get into that space and maneuver around so that you can close that door.
Are they all sit-in?
Are they all sit-in? Some of them, Michelle, do you know? Are some of them deep enough? Some of the tubs long enough that you can actually lie down in?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And if I may say, unfortunately, there are new walking tubs now that can drain very quickly.
Yeah. All right. So Michelle's one of my neighbors and owners of a mobility supply store down Bayview, so yeah.
Sorry, I have another question.
Yes.
Could you speak a little about personal devices?
About personal devices?
Personal devices, like, for people who are alone, especially. especially.
Yeah, and do you mean personal alarms, like emergency devices? Yeah. So in terms of the personal emergency devices, again, there's a number of different companies who produce different products. Some of them are intended and designed really to just monitor and to be usable within a proximity to the main set. So it's really only useful inside the home. There's a number of other products, or it might be a different model within the same product line, where because it's using more GPS systems, it works both inside and outside the home. I'm an advocate, I guess I can say that, of people wearing a device and pressing it when they need to. But again, it's one of those things that, ironically enough, well, a couple of things. One is sometimes people's family get it for them, so they actually have no interest in wearing it and they don't wear it. And I always say it has no value sitting in your bedside, you know, stand or in the bathroom, so you need to wear it to make it useful. Or then the other thing is people who do wear it and fall or run into difficulty, they don't want to bother anybody, so they don't press the button. And that defeats the purpose too. So I certainly would recommend that. If you have a health condition where you are at risk for blacking out, passing out, so you may fall and not be able to press the button, whether it's around your neck or you wear it around your wrist, a number of them have that fall detector technology, so you don't have to have the ability, either physically or cognitively, to press that. It's going to detect your fall, and then it will, again, contact whichever numbers you've identified. But great question. Yeah.
I have two ideas mm-hmm. in my house that work.
Great.
One is I have a very narrow stairs.
Yes.
And I haven't got room for a handbar on each side.
Okay.
But I have a rope.
Yes.
My rope happens to be, you could buy, there are different ones. I have one that actually was made in England, but there are ones made in North America.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes a lot of difference for me getting upstairs.
And so how do you use the rope?
Like the rope has fittings all the way up.
Yeah, so I'm going to repeat the question or the comment. So this lady's saying that she does not have room due to the narrowness of her stairs for handrails on both sides, but she's using a rope with fittings or I guess maybe knots every so often. So you can put your hand above the notch and then sort of pull yourself up. Yeah. You can hold the mic right close.
The other thing I have is a mat.
Yes.
It's by my sink. It's a long mat.
Mm-hmm.
They come in different colors, and they're very easy to stand on.
Yes.
Much easier than standing on. I happen to have a brick floor on my kitchen.
Yeah.
So this makes it much easier to stand on, and they don't have edges that you can trip on.
Right.
They're not cheap.
Yes.
But I found it really worthwhile.
Yeah, I think they call them like anti-shock mats or whatever. They
yeah,
often have memory foam.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're not inexpensive, but they're great. They take the shock absorption from your legs, from your body, and she's using them in the kitchen, which is where a lot of people use them. That's great. Yes. Okay. Yes.
Do you know the chairs I'm talking about, those chairs that are electric, you know, you get around the home in?
Power wheelchair?
I guess that's what it's
yes,
referred
yes.
to.
Yes, yes.
Could you address the funding question to that? And because some people may need those eventually, or if not.
Yes, sooner. Okay. So, and thank you. I can talk a lot, as you can see, so I'm going to skip ahead. And so this gentleman's asking about provincial funding through the assistive devices program for mobility devices. So whether it's a walker, whether it's a manual wheelchair or a power wheelchair, every citizen in the province of Ontario is entitled to be assessed and apply for funding through the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care for up to 75% of the cost of basic and essential equipment. So as I say, that's a walker, a manual wheelchair or a power wheelchair or possibly a scooter. And so it's a strict eligibility criteria. You have to require the use of that device
within your home in order to allow you to move around your home, or in the case of a condo or an apartment building or a senior's residence, to be able to access not only your suite or your unit, but also other areas of the building. So if you need to be able to use the wheelchair or the scooter to get from your unit to the front door or to the mailbox or to the laundry, then, you know, as long as the therapist who's assessing and evaluating you determines that you meet all of the eligibility criterion, then you're able to apply to the government and receive up to 75% funding. The government does not provide funding for those devices in place of transportation. So particularly when we're talking about electric scooters, if you used to drive but you've given up driving for whatever reason but still want to be able to get to and from the store but don't want to take the bus, don't want to pay for a taxi, etc., the government will not buy you a scooter for that reason. Does that answer your question? Okay, great. Great,
hi.
Yeah.
So earlier you were speaking about the changes to your home.
Yes.
Physical, like the size of the hallway mm-hmm. or counters and things like that. One of the things that many people have to be aware of and have experienced are fraudulent contractors or, mm-hmm. or people who just aren't qualified to do the work that they say they can do. They charge money and then they don't do it or whatever. What's your sense of the industry of people who are contractors who focus specifically on modifying your house for aging in place?
Yeah.
That's one question. The second question as well.
Okay.
I'll give you the second question. Now, in the building code, there are requirements for how high a receptacle has to be from the ground or mm-hmm. where it can be located, the type of receptacle or the light switch, how high from the floor, that kind of thing. So the changes that you're suggesting, how do they sit with the building code? So
okay.
Those two questions.
Great. Excellent questions. Thank you for both of them. So in terms of how to basically select and ensure that you're working with a reputable contractor, a number of different things to consider. One is on the Canada Mortgage and Housing website, there are guides that basically direct you some questions that you can be asking of a contractor. And then quite recently, the Canadian Home Builders Association, and this is not only open to home builders, it would be open to contractors as well, has brought up from the U.S. what is called the Certified Aging in Place Specialty Program. So it's a training program that anybody involved in the renovation and construction business is able to take and strongly encouraged to take. So if you're wanting to basically vet a contractor, asking them if they have this, what's called CAPS, so Certified Aging in Place Specialist Certification. That's one way of basically establishing a level playing field, because it's a fairly rigorous certification program that they need to go through. Now, there are other individuals who have great experience, and so by using the checklist, what questions to ask your contractor would be a way to vet that. And obviously, as with any situation, if you can have a word-of-mouth referral, somebody that you know who has used this contractor before, that's another great way to get that referral. Then with regards to the building code, so this is interesting because, of course, the building code, where it applies to housing, the primary focus is on fire and life safety. Other aspects of the building code that basically fall in line with the residential aspects of home building design, the placement of light switches, the circulation space in terms of a 5-foot turning circle, etc. Those are minimums, and a qualified contractor, a qualified builder, is absolutely going to be able to work with and satisfy the building code and still comply with the building code requirements. So it's a matter of the building code is not always functional, and that's why with the B651 through the Canadian Standards Association, we actually included a chapter around residential design guidelines, and there are a number of design guidelines which meet code. In fact, it exceeds code, and that's, again, can sometimes be a challenge because builders and developers or contractors know the code and they know they have to build to it. It's not everybody who thinks about going beyond it. And when we're talking about universal design features, that's what we mean.
Margot, you have commented on a wide range of wonderful physical elements. I just wanted to add a comment about a mental element. Mm-hmm. I've lived alone for 12 years. When we're young, we tend to think we're infallible, and we tend to, you know, do things that we probably shouldn't as we age when that infallibility level drops substantially. And I want to introduce this think safety. After I started living alone, I would run around and do this and do that. I wouldn't turn on a light. I wouldn't worry about this or worry about that. I suddenly realized that you have to start thinking safety. Now, that's a hard thing to do, to continually every morning that you get up to think about turning on a light when it's a little dark. Before, I used to just rush in, oh, you know, I can do this without turning on the light. No, you can't. I now think every day I get up, I think safety. Turn on lights, remove that obstacle from the floor in case I get up at night. And also moving your body. You know, as you age, as some of us around the room think, the skin gets thinner and thinner, and all you have to do is touch yourself on something sharp. And I had an incident a few months ago where I developed, just by turning and hitting something sharp, a substantial wound. So think about your every movement, and it's very difficult to do, but thinking safety is an important element, and I've got a member of my family, a daughter, who keeps reminding me of this, and I've slowly evolved to the point where I think safety. So I'm suggesting to everybody, keep that in mind.
Terrific. Yeah, thank you so much for that. And yes, I do apologize for talking as much as I did and not being able to necessarily touch on the whole range of things, but excellent questions and comments that people have made. And I think rather than keeping longer cutting off conversation. Obviously, you've got additional information in terms of a few more slides that I didn't get through. You also have my contact information in terms of my phone number as well as my website and email address. We do have time for more questions or comments if people want. And you've got the brochure that also highlights the services. The thing that I wanted to mention as well is the planning guide and checklist for planning to age in place. It was a large document that I wasn't able to print and bring, but if anybody would like a copy, if you want to send me an email or I'll get your contact information today, I'd be more than happy to email you a copy of that and you can go through the checklist yourself.
For the in-house mobility devices, mm-hmm. are there financial eligibility criteria?
Do you mean in terms of walkers?
No, I'm thinking about motorized.
Power mobility devices such as a power wheelchair or a scooter. Yes, there are. So that assistive devices program, you would need to be assessed by a therapist who's an authorizer to determine whether or not you're eligible. The challenge with the scooters in particular, unless you've got lots of maneuvering space in your home or you have a very compact model, scooter's probably not practical. And looking at a power wheelchair, you would need to require that on an ongoing daily basis as your basic mobility device.
My real question was, though, do you have to have a certain income level to be eligible?
Oh, okay. So the question is, in terms of, is it income tested? And no. At this time, it's not means tested, so it's not eligibility in terms of if your income is above or below. It's eligible to every citizen of Ontario who has a permanent physical disability.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, there are some apartment buildings, older ones perhaps, where the width of the doorway is too narrow mm-hmm. for a wheelchair.
Yes.
I think a lot of people don't take that into consideration.
Right. So the issue there that this woman is raising is around the width of doorways, especially bathroom doorways. They sometimes are narrower than other interior doorways in apartment buildings. And so if you are looking to relocate, you want to make sure that you're measuring that distance and either evaluating if it's wide enough for a walker or if you might need a commode or a walker in the future if it's going to accommodate that. The other thing is, if it's a rental unit, you may be able to talk to the landlord about making some modifications. And if it's a matter of an inch or two, you can actually get swing away door hinges that buy you that little bit of extra width that is sometimes all you need to do without a major renovation in terms of widening doorways, which might also involve moving electrical outlets, etc. Okay. Yeah.
I just have one more question. It has to do with mobility.
Yeah.
The government said by 2020 that all publicly accessed spaces should be accessible to the disabled, and you mentioned lots of disability issues here. What is it that we can do here on our level to encourage that transformation? It's happened a lot in government. It's happened a lot in the what do you call it, voluntary sector, but the private sector is really sadly...
Yeah.
Really not up to speed on this. And
right.
Because a lot of mobility issues, you mentioned accessibility issues, you know, in the home.
Mm-hmm.
But then when we go out of the home,
yes,
we're confronted with these barriers. What can people do
to
address that?
So the question is, what as, you know, individual citizens can you do to try and promote greater accessibility in public spaces? And you are correct that the Ontarians with Disabilities Act does require that by 2025 that very specific sectors of public spaces must be accessible to all individuals. And if they meet that 2025 deadline, it's going to be a miracle because it's like people are just waking up now and realizing. But anyway, in regards to what you can do, and this is partly why I called my company Inclusive Aging, I think it's really, really important that when you are interacting with a business, whether it's your bank, whether it's your grocery store, a movie theater, a senior center, whatnot, that you make a point of accessibility challenges that you might have. And whether that's mobility, whether that's lighting, whether that's acoustics, whether it's that there's not a sharps container in the bathroom if you're doing injections with your diabetes, whatever it might be, bring it to the attention of whomever's responsible for that facility or for that business. You know, as a demographic, baby boomers and the older population, the fastest growing segment of the Canadian population are people 85 and older. And not to say that all older adults are, you know, tremendously wealthy, but you have an incredible amount of buying power and clout and political influence. So both from a consumer standpoint and obviously at election time, make sure that you're speaking with your candidates and raising any issues or concerns that you have. Because that idea of, I really wish somebody would do something about this, always we need to look in the mirror first and say, I am that somebody.
I think we're going to just have time for one more question over here, and then I think Margot is probably willing to stick around and answer individual
Absolutely.
Questions.
Mm-hmm.
But let's take that one last question before we wrap.
At what school do the builders go to be certified for CAP?
Yeah, so it's through the Canadian Home Builders Association. So they would need to be a member of that organization, or there's probably a non-member rate in order to take that. And it's not offered specifically through one education institution. It's put on either through an education center, or it may even be at a hotel. And they're running the sessions across Canada. So if you have a contractor or a builder that you think may be interested, they can go on the Canadian Home Builders website to find out more information. Great. Thank you so much, everybody. I really appreciate your attention and your interest in the topic today.
Thank you, Margot. That was absolutely tremendous. As you can see from all the questions, there's a huge amount of interest in what you had to say. Happily, Margot is also going to be joining us for our community fair. Please mark your calendars, March 8th. We're going to have a number of service providers again this year attending who will be able to provide a cross-section of providers that will be able to provide lots of valuable information, Margot among them. So please mark that in your calendars. I want to give a special thanks to Peter Long. Yay! Thanks for helping us out, Peter. That was tremendous. And I want to acknowledge once again, just before closing, our sponsors who have made this series possible, Dell Manor, Christie Gardens, and the Dunfield. And I want to thank all of you for coming. So hope to see you on the 8th. Thanks again.